Hello, and welcome to our next lecture for Western Civilization 1. This lecture is on the Greek polis. Now, we've talked about the polis some, but I want to review it because it's an idea and a concept in Western civilization, and particularly Greek history, that's absolutely essential to understand. So what is a polis? Well, some people have said it's a city-state, city-state, and that's okay. But I would prefer in your writing and in your discussion, you rather just say the word polis, and we all understand what you mean by that, because it really is unique from many city-states in history. So remember, the word is polis, P-O-L-I-S. The plural is P-O-L-E-I-S, polis. And we just don't have an equivalent in English, so we're going to use the word polis. Also remember that there are many English words with the word polis in it somehow. So remember our English word political, politics, all of that comes from polis. Cities like Indianapolis, metropolis, all of these have the name polis in them. So in some cases, it's taken for kind of a generic name for city. But what these were, the polis of Greece, were independent, autonomous, that means self-ruling, political units. There's some elements of most polis that you need to know. Most of them were comprised of about 5,000 citizens. Now, to make it clear, citizens were adult males. So that does not include women, that does not include children, that does not include foreigners, that does not include slaves. So keep in mind, when we say 5,000, the total number of any given polis would probably be much more than double of that. But 5,000 was an average number. In fact, Aristotle, who was famous for studying all the polis of Greece, and really, or as many of the polis as he could, and giving birth to the field we know of as political science, said that 5,000 was the ideal number. To him, that was the perfect number, and there's several reasons for that. He said that everyone could know everyone, that you could at least know every family, that you could know most male faces you saw. So there's a sense of intimacy and community allowed. There's not a lot of strangers. Think about in your average day when you're out and about how many strangers you see. Well, that's in part because most cities we live in are huge, 200,000, 300,000. But in a polis, that wasn't the case. It was a much smaller number. You had in any given polis, according to Aristotle, public and private together. In other words, there was a mix of public concerns and private concerns. But most important for Aristotle is that you had a highly involved citizenry in your average polis. That means that the citizens, the adult males who had the rights of a citizen, were very, very involved in the affairs of their city, which, keep in mind, was the affairs of their country. So to compare to our situation, even if, say, your dad's the mayor of the town you live in, that's still not your country. That's only local politics. But for the average citizen of a Greek polis, your city was your country. So to be highly involved meant that everyone who was a citizen was very in touch with all the most important affairs of your polis. Remember, Aristotle is famous for the saying, man is a political animal. I'll translate it this way. Man is a creature whose habitat, whose environment in which he thrives best, is a polis. So to Aristotle, a man in an empire, a man in a vast monarchy with a bureaucracy far away, was about like a tiger in a cage in a zoo. All right, he was not in his ideal environment, but the polis was the ideal environment because it involved knowing one another and involved participation with everyone. I should also add that there's an English word we have, idiot. Well, it comes from a Greek word, idiotes. And to the citizens of polis, a man who was a citizen but who was not involved in the affairs of the state and who kept to himself was an idiotes. He was an idiot. This was not seen as a good thing. It was very important for all the citizens of a polis to be intimately involved in their city. In addition, most citizens of a polis were farmers of some kind. They typically would have had about 10 acres of land, so they didn't have a huge farm. Obviously, you couldn't have a huge farm without the modern farming equipment that we have. So imagine your average citizen. He has about 10 acres of land on which he has goats, and he probably grows olives or grapes or both. And what surplus he grows, he's able to trade to buy grain and other things that he might need. He might sell cheese as well, or maybe meat. Probably he has a slave, usually only one. Or two. You know, he's not got an enormous estate, and so he doesn't need a lot of slaves. You know, we think of slavery in America, and we think of the vast plantations of the South that could have 50 up to 100 slaves. Well, in this case, it was one slave, and probably more a part of the family. So there's your average citizen, a farmer of some kind. He may have some other businesses, but most people farmed. One slave with a business out of his home. I think we've mentioned before that the Greeks believed that to live in another form of government was barbaric. We've also mentioned, I believe, that barbarian is an onomatopoeia. It's meant, remember, an onomatopoeia is a word like splash or bang. It's a word that sounds like the noise it describes. Well, a barbarian is someone also who didn't speak Greek. They connected not speaking Greek with not living in a polis. So a barbarian is somebody who went bar, 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 bar. Sort of equivalent to a blah, to blah, blah in English. So a barbarian, you might say, is a blah, blah-ian or something like that. At any rate, most polis, from what we understand, emerge in this unique geography of Greece where there's not a lot of arable land and there's lots of mountains and rocky areas sectioning off the various areas. It's hard to unify them. It's not like Egypt with a Nile River to unify them. Most of them are hugging the Aegean Sea. Again, there's not a lot of rivers, so they're close to the sea. And most polis, from what we can tell, emerge from what is called the Acropolis, which was some sort of high defensible point where the farmers in any given area could retreat to when there was some sort of invasion. So usually these were walled. And as time went by, this Acropolis broadened out and developed and became a center of trade. It became a center of the governance of that polis and the region around it. It became the center of culture, religious festivals. And so all of these things went on eventually in this Acropolis. So here we have these 5,000 citizens, 5,000 households with their own household economy, all sort of independent, but working together, trading together, known by one another. It was said of the Greeks in a polis that a Greek they liked to live in town. They liked to live near the Acropolis, where they could walk to their fields, but spend their free time in the city talking. Now, hopefully this reminds you of what it says in Acts about the Athenians. In Acts chapter 17 and verse 21, it says, "Now all the Athenians and the foreigners who lived there would spend their time in nothing except telling or hearing something new." And I think we've also mentioned the gymnasia. The gymnasia were these places where men came together to train and to compete and to keep their bodies honed, ready for battle. Also where they would obviously, because everyone was involved, get together and discuss the politics of the day and have their arguments. So imagine these gymnasia and these acropolis as very vibrant places where there's lots of activity, lots of talking, lots of leisure, lots of interaction. I think I've also said that the polis of Greece developed in a period of time. It was sort of a little niche of history, a little unique situation where there were no vast empires for a while conquering them, nothing threatening this new sort of experimental way of life. And so it allowed for a great deal of experimentation. I think we've mentioned before that the polis were very different. Some were ruled by the richest. Some were ruled by a small council of leaders. They were an oligarchy. Some were ruled by nobility, however they were classified, whether it was by wealth or something else. Some were ruled by a king with a council. Some, like Athens, eventually develop a very radical democracy. But this is in part why Aristotle could learn so much about political science, because there were so many different varieties of government in all these different polis. It created this incredible experimentation and incredible variety among the polis. There was also no economic unity. These polis traded with one another. Sometimes there would be feuds between polis. Sometimes there would be wars between polis. In fact, this is another element of the polis that you need to know. Your average citizen was very involved in the government, was very involved in politics. And finally, when it came time for the city to defend itself or fight, he went and strapped on his bronze armor and went and fought with his fellow citizens. So they're very involved in many, many things, the most important elements of the life of the polis. They lived together, they traded together, they ran their government together, they fought and died together for their way of life. So you can see why there's this certain pride and there's this certain sense that this is the ideal way to live. I should also mention that the Greeks developed a style of fighting that was incredibly innovative and incredibly powerful. They were military innovators, and a small group of these fighters could defeat a much larger group. They had armor, bronze armor, chest, head, shins. They had very big shields, sometimes as tall as a man. They had long spears. And what they would do is get shoulder to shoulder with their shields interlocked, with several lines behind them, 8 lines behind. And they would be like this big turtle with spikes that would press into the enemy and break the enemy line and defeat them that way. These soldiers were called hoplites. And this military unit is called the hoplite phalanx. And it was very effective, as we'll see during the Persian Wars. They're going to defeat a 10 times at least larger military force with this military innovation. So, here we have the polis. It is the Acropolis and the people that use the Acropolis. It is that very city center, and everyone who lives in the region, like all that lived in the Attic Peninsula, they were Athenians who had all their life sort of related to the Acropolis and the town center there in Athens. It is a community whose the affairs of everyone were the affairs of all. It is a government that, even if it has a king, is highly accountable. You can't be a king of a small kingdom where everybody's there and involved and not be accountable. So these kings, even though they were kings in some of these polis, were more accountable than your average king of a large empire. You had small local justice. Think about that. Justice, whatever the outcome of justice, would be swift and quick. Because you didn't have to wait for years for something to go to a Supreme Court way off. So this small size was the virtue of these polis. And the Greeks thought of life in a polis as a virtue, as a way of life that was far superior to others. I should also mention, if you haven't figured this out, that it was polis, and particularly the polis of Athens, that creates democracy. Now, you should know that the democracy of Athens was incredibly volatile, because at some points in their history, every citizen could vote on every law. Laws could be turned over quickly. They didn't have a constitution as such. So it was very volatile and very unstable. And so, by comparison, our democracy is a much more stable form of democracy because it's based on a constitution. And in fact, the founding fathers even built things into our constitution to slow things down. So the democracy of Athens was quite radical. Okay, I want to take a few minutes now and describe two of the most important polis for our purposes, the polis of Sparta and the polis of Athens. I'll start with Sparta. Sparta is in the southern end on the western shores of the Aegean. It was a city-state or polis that was more military in style. In fact, they were known as having the most powerful military in all of Athens. During the Persian invasion in the 5th century BC, when various polis armies of various polis met up on their way to meet the Persian invasions and they saw what seemed to them like a small force from Sparta, they said, "We thought you would send more." And the Spartans said, "Well, what do you do?" And the guy would say, "I'm a baker." And he'd say, "What do you do?" And he would say, "Well, I'm a farmer." And he'd say, "What do you do?" He'd say, "I'm a fisherman." And the Spartans would say, "We did send more," because every Spartan male spent all his time training for battle. Early on in Sparta's history, they conquered a neighboring polis and enslaved the entire population. And that population, for the rest of Sparta's history, fed Sparta. They did the manual labor to provide food for themselves and the Spartans. And so the Spartans were able to devote all of their time to military training. The Spartans were ruled by a military ruling class. Children in Sparta were understood as belonging to the state. In fact, we find pits there in Sparta where apparently, at birth, every child was examined, and if they were physically unfit, they were thrown in the pit. They were killed. Boys moved to barracks between the ages of 6 and 8 and stayed in those military barracks for the rest of their really adult lives, sometimes up until the age of 60. So imagine that. All your life lived in military training in barracks with other men. At age 18, they were given to military service, but even up until that point, for as much as 10 years, they'd been in military training. At the age of 30, you're considered an adult. And as I said, most of these men stayed in military barracks, and ate in those military barracks until 60. So they visited their homes if they got married, they did not live there. I should also add that women trained for battle as well, but they weren't typically sent, but it was understood that a Spartan woman should be tough. By the way, I should mention now that word Spartan, for us it means simple, spare, tough, somebody with not a lot of words. Well, that's what you should think of when you think of Spartans. I should also add that they had a lot of unique elements, like when they went into battle, they would often comb their hair. This was sort of a way of saying they really weren't worried about much. They were cool cucumbers, and as they prepared for battle, they were preparing for how they looked because they really weren't worried about how they would fight because they knew they would fight well. So the Spartans had this very regimented lifestyle where they regulated almost every area of their life and civic life. So you get an idea of what Sparta was like. Probably not a place where there was a lot of art. Well, that should make you think of Athens. So let's look at Athens. Now, Athens has a tumultuous political history. They go through periods of kings, they go through a period of tyrants, they go through the development of democracy. And as I said, it was up and down. Eventually, they have a radical democracy where most of their important positions were filled by lottery. They have a large assembly where most of their laws were passed, and the assembly was a place where any citizen could speak. And so what eventually emerges is those who can speak well, rhetoricians or rhetors, we would call them, Rhetors, were very powerful. They could be very influential. If you could sway the assembly and get them to vote on the spot for your policy, you could be a very important person. So they had this very large assembly that all citizens could be a part of and theoretically speak in and have a vote in. And they develop, because they have a democracy and because they have a less developed life, Athens becomes the center of the explosion of arts. They have an annual festival in the honor of Dionysus where drama is born and where some of the most famous plays, well, some of the first plays of all, and really this was the center of drama and the creation of drama. Philosophy is born there with Socrates, and then his student Plato and Plato's student Aristotle. So the foundations of Western philosophy are there. Architecture, maybe the most famous of architecture of the Greeks is the Parthenon. This is the temple to Athena Nike that's on the Acropolis there in Athens. By the way, I should mention that the Parthenon, there's a scale replica of the Parthenon in Nashville, Tennessee. And you can go see it today. It has a statue of Athena Nike inside. She's holding a small statue of the god Nike, who is the god of victory. So at any rate, Athens emerges as the more arts and creative of these polis. I should also add that Athens developed a very powerful navy. As time goes by, it's a very military-oriented navy, but they were the traders. And so throughout the history of Greece, Athens will emerge as having the most powerful navy. Sparta will emerge as having the most powerful land, the infantry army. So these are the two most important polis. I should add there were hundreds of other polis, and they all were known for various things, maybe pottery or certain sports. They all had things that they were known for, things that they were famous for. But all of these together take up this innovation, or represent this innovation called the polis. And remember, I will point you again to Anthony Esalen's point in your book that he calls this the Greek Isle effect. When you have all this political experimentation, when you have this shared heritage of culture and a freedom for each of these polis to develop, there's an enormous amount of creativity. So a shared tradition, a active involvement of all participants is responsible for the countless contributions to Western civilization that the polis of Greek brought. In the next lecture, we will go into greater detail on the development and the details of Greek philosophy.